Hello from Rome. It's Kristen. Thanks so much for listening to Election Intrigue, the podcast. It's a special one because it's actually our last one. The election, as you all know, has come to an end. And with that, the Election Intrigue podcast. But fear not, we are going to continue a podcast in some form, likely with guests or just on news of the week. So you'll hear many more of John's expert takes, reporting from on the ground from me, and all the in-between. Again, we're going to have some more guests. So if you know of anyone who would be a great representative to throw on the podcast, give our audience a view, please write to us. We'd be happy to hear. And as always, make sure to read the daily International Intrigue. John, myself, Valentina, JD, Helen, Anya, Danny, we all touch that daily product and work on it, fine-tune it, and interject the latest, most necessary insights over the past 24 hours in your inbox every weekday morning. So, in the meantime, take a look at that. But on to the last Election Intrigue podcast. Thanks so much for following along across our journey.
Hello, Kristen. It feels like it's been a little while since we've chatted.
I know, it's been a hot minute.
You'll
hear. And there's lots that's happened.
Well, there is a lot that's happening. You'll hear my voice is almost back up to full strength, for better or worse. Our listeners may have differing views on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm feeling a lot better. Thank you for bearing with me, everybody, last week as I was quite sick. I have no idea if it was COVID because I didn't get a test, but there's always that possibility. But we're back and up and running. Although I will say this will be the last official episode of Election Intrigue, the last newsletter, the last podcast. We're going to continue this podcast in some form or another. We haven't quite figured out what that form will be yet. So if you've got ideas, please let us know. But we thought we'd wrap up the final Election Intrigue. It's still the election is obviously over, but we wanted to talk a little bit about Trump's cabinet picks and some of the folks he's decided are going to run the government for the next 4 years and have a chat about that. But before that, Kristen, you have been and still are in Rome, in Italy. Tell us what you're doing there and what you've seen over the last couple of days.
Right, yeah. Well, first of all, just remarking at how much people can enjoy their lives here. I feel like I can't. I'm like, no, I need the taxi right now. I need to be there right now.
You're saying your American kind of vibe doesn't fit in with the Italian attitude?
Right, I'm remembering to breathe in, breathe out, and go with the flow. As much as I can. But yeah, it's a big week here in Rome because the foreign ministers are meeting for the G7. So Italy is the G7 host, which means over the past year, they have hosted different various meetings, economic meetings, foreign minister meetings, prime minister meetings, heads of state, rather. And so the foreign ministers are meeting this week in Rome. And there's also the Mediterranean Dialogues, which is hosted by the Italian Foreign Ministry. And it's essentially one of those conferences where they've rounded up all of these big foreign minister names, you know, the foreign minister of Lebanon, the foreign minister of Jordan, the foreign minister of Somalia, North Macedonia, Croatia, all here, and lots of other big names talking about essentially how they see the world and the state of the world. And it's quite, it's kind of one of the biggest conferences post the Trump election. So it's telling and interesting to hear lots of worldviews. And it's quite interesting because there's potentially about to be a ceasefire in the Israel-Hezbollah conflict. And the Lebanon foreign minister was here. So lots of news making.
Yeah, well, actually, something you said at the very start of that I think is interesting for people to know, that the G7, the G20, all these summits, they're like year-long things. We focus on them, tend to focus on them when the leaders go and they make a statement, and those statements are invariably pretty boring and you know, I'm being cynical, but that's true. But year round, the host countries are hosting these kinds of meetings, as you said, like finance ministers coming together to agree various things on that, the secretaries of state or foreign ministers. You have even working level, you know, immigration, all these people come together. It's this idea that you have a host country facilitating governments talking to each other across all the different functions of government. So I think that's a good point to note. You mentioned also that there's this background of war, I guess, in the Middle East, and Italy's, you know, I don't think it has a traditional role as a kind of peacemaking country in the sense of like, it's not Qatar or the US or the UK sometimes gets involved in facilitating these ceasefires. Sweden has a pretty big role in that, Switzerland from time to time. What has been the vibe in Italy? Is there a focus in the national papers on this stuff? Do the Italians care about this? The people you've been talking to in the corridors of this conference, are they focused on this, or is it kind of not as important in a place like Italy as it is in the US, for example?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And Italy, where it's geographically located, right? Because at the end of the day, we're all just our geography. They're a key focal point in the Mediterranean. And one of the panelists said it quite bluntly, where she was like, you know, Italy and the EU, they like to strike these deals with North Africa, Middle Eastern countries, and like to call it economic deals. Really, they're migration deals. And Italy is particularly focused on migration flows and international migration flows, or sorry, irregular migration flows would be the exact term that's used. And so Italy does have quite a big stance, and especially Meloni has harnessed a lot of power since the EU elections. And so Italy's place on the world stage right now is quite prominent. I mean, Meloni's role has become much of a facilitator, especially, as I said, since the EU election, since Macron's leadership has looked a little bit more testy since the French elections over the summer. So really, I would say that the main focal point of the conference is the Mediterranean focus. And considering that Lebanon, Israel, Cyprus, which now is becoming sort of this military hub, Greece, Turkey, all these countries touch the Mediterranean, Italy is really a facilitator of those dialogues. And this is actually the 10th time, I guess, that they've hosted this dialogue, and it is really well attended, I must say. I mean, I've met people from the Central Bank of Bahrain. I met Omanis here. You know, all people that you give your card to, they never give you theirs, and then you never hear from them again. But you know, for what it's worth, they are in attendance.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point too that we made it a couple of times that the foreign is very connected to the domestic in the modern world. I mean, I think that it's almost an artificial delineation to call foreign policy and domestic policy separate things. We wrote today in International Intrigue about the new Treasury Secretary of the US, and his role is really just chief global Western free market diplomat. That's what his role is. I mean, obviously he has a domestic economic focus in the US, but that's his role. I mean, we saw Janet Yellen go to China a bunch, all that kind of stuff. The other one that is there's no real delineation is immigration, and the Mediterranean, Europe are understanding how important migration, irregular migration, legal migration, regulating that. They're understanding how important that is for domestic politics. You know, I think mainstream media would call that, you know, critical to the rise of the far right. And obviously Giorgia Meloni in Italy was billed as a far right politician, although I think she's been somewhat more mainstream as she's been governing. But I guess the broader point is that these things are not foreign or domestic. They're both, they're linked. And that's the way it's going to be forever now, unless the world completely deglobalizes, which seems unlikely. Before we move off that, is there anything else that you wanted to point out about being there in Rome? We're trying to do a lot more in-person reporting in 2025. And I think it's important to get a sense of these places on the ground. I guess the question would be, it's a very generic question, take it how you want, but is it optimistic or is it pessimistic? Because I often get asked, is the world going to hell? And like, it's almost kind of like sexy to be nihilistic about, oh God, another dumpster fire, ha 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 ha. And I think that comes from the media just focusing on negative things because people read negative things. But in the rooms where people are making decisions, the people who have money and power, are they as negative and are they as nihilistic, or is it just a media kind of thing?
Yeah, there was a panel about midday today that was led and chaired by the UN Grand Bargain Ambassador, which I never knew existed, but apparently
I've never heard of that in my life.
Right. But apparently the Grand Bargain, something that was started in Istanbul in the 2010. Essentially, the bottom line is he asked these panelists who were all think tankers or whatnot, so they could speak a little bit more freely, right, than the foreign ministers who have to be a little bit more buttoned up, but definitely very well respected and therefore invited to be panelists. He said, what would you say to the student who says, hey, I want to go study international law? Would you say like, well, screw it. That's not worth anything now. So right. Like, don't question. Even go do that. It was a great question. It was a great panel, actually. Normally, sometimes journalists don't even really tune into the panels where think tankers speak at because they don't tend to make news, right? You're not going to go write a headline on some XYZ think tanker said this. But it was a great question. And all of these people, many of them who work with the UN or UN, you know, accredited or whatever you want to say, NGOs, they were like, no, we wouldn't say that, but it absolutely needs to be completely rechanged. And I think that felt like that's kind of felt like the overarching narrative that
as in things isn't really working. Are changing and this isn't working. We need to find new solutions.
This isn't working. We need to find a solution. Things like the Grand Bargain, which this UN ambassador is in charge of, which I guess is actually sort of like, if you look into it, their definition is to work better with linking NGOs with the, like, it's, these are attempts, right, to rework, but that was started in 2015 or 2016. That hasn't changed the international system. It hasn't changed the UN. It hasn't made it the great bargain that it is, right? So I think the sentiment is something needs to change. And something that was said, that's been said over the different panels is we can't have one policy towards Ukraine, a different towards Israel, and a third towards Sudan. And that is the overarching. I don't know if we've reached this point, though, where someone's offering a solution that is a breakthrough solution. No. And I think that's where you see people like Meloni, who you mentioned, that used to be sort of cast off as right the far right when she was elected 2 years ago, but now seems pretty mainstream. So the dial is shifting, but who is going to be, you know, the Angela Merkel or the leader who's going to sort of carve the path is very unclear. And these European leaders are extremely uncertain about Trump coming in. I mean, I said to one person, the ambassador of the Vatican, I went up to him after one of his panels, you know, and I started talking and they're like, are you American? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, good luck. So, you know, it's there's a lot hinging on the next 60 days to January 20th and beyond.
Yeah, I think we'll move on, but I think what you're getting at is something even larger than, you know, foreign policy or you know, multilateral institutions. It's this idea of how do human organizations change? Like, how do they meaningfully change? And the reality is I am incredibly, incredibly cynical about the ability of the international system to change by coming up with solutions at think tank love-ins where people who come up with the ideas have a vested interest in the system continuing precisely as it is. You know, that's a story as old as time and as old as history, that it's very difficult to actually change big overarching systems of bureaucratic kind of excess from the inside. They traditionally need external disruptive forces, which is a problem when those disruptive forces are, you know, China, Iran, Russia, the kinds of folks who don't want to remake the world in a way that benefits many of us who would like to see it continue in the way it has been going. But anyway, we digress a little bit. Let's pivot a little bit back to election intrigue. I want to talk about some of the cabinet appointees. So background here is obviously Trump was elected almost 3 weeks ago now, which has flown, to be honest, although he has not stopped making news since he was elected. And Biden, I don't think, has made news since he became the outgoing president. Let's talk about three people in particular. I want to talk about Marco Rubio, who's the Secretary of State nominee presumably the nominee. We should probably talk about Scott Bessent, who we've both just done some research on how to pronounce his name. And apparently it is Bessent, like percent or Bessent. Maybe it's, I've already forgotten what it is. Is it percent? It's Bessent.
Bessent, yeah.
Okay,
there we go. I keep wanting to say Bessent.
Yeah, so did I just said it then. Maybe we're trying to make him French when he's very much not French. So we're going to talk about him. And then perhaps some of the hangers on around there. Tulsi Gabbard as national security advisor is an interesting one to me. I think, you know, there's not a lot to say about Elise Stefanik, who's going to be the UN ambassador, but we'll give it a go. So why don't you kick us off, Marco Rubio? He's obviously the senator from Florida. He's a pretty establishment figure, I think you could argue, in today's Republican Party anyway. He seems to be relatively well respected in foreign policy circles. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, on a larger scale, when I look at these picks like Marco Rubio, Besant, they are well-respected people in foreign policy circles, treasury circles. There was this big idea that Trump would come in and totally reshape Foggy Bottom, and Washington, Foggy Bottom, the whole establishment, which in some ways, right, you could say that his defense pick has been so. But Rubio is a respected politician with decades of experience and well-respected in foreign policy circles. So him helming the State Department is probably a little bit of a sigh of relief. And there's two things that I would say maybe have fed into this decision. First of all, when Trump came to power in his first term in 2017, when he took the Oval Office and he put into place his various cabinet picks, there was a big exodus from the State Department. Perhaps with a pick like Rubio, you won't see this big exodus from Foggy Bottom, which could be a sign of continuity and sort of not this, you know, let's throw it all up, which is interesting considering some of his claims on the campaign trail. Also, Rubio has respected contacts and partners in Congress and different agencies across Washington, which is interesting for a few reasons, that he'll be able to work with people, which, you know, you would think, considering Trump's mandate, considering that has more Senate seats now, that he has taken the House, that he wouldn't necessarily have to be so concerned about some of these picks and making sure he doesn't upset the balance. But, you know, it seems like he's gone with a safe pick for Secretary of State, and Rubio will probably be able to do the role really well and interact with international partners quite well. He probably, and his office has contacts across Europe, across the Middle East, across Asia. So that shows that they can kind of quickly get to work in some ways too.
Yeah, I'm interested in why Trump chose Marco Rubio. It's not clear to me that he owed Marco Rubio anything. He'd already defeated Marco Rubio, like, comprehensively, belittled him, you know, called him Little Marco. Like, Marco Rubio wasn't a threat politically. He also wasn't a huge MAGA guy. Like, he's obviously a supporter of the president and has said the right things and kissed the ring and done all that stuff. But he wasn't kind of someone I think Trump felt like he had to pay back in the same way that maybe Elon Musk or these folks who kind of really stuck their neck out for Trump when they didn't need to. So I was kind of like, why would he select Marco Rubio? He could have given that job to someone he needed to give a favor to, or he could have given that job to someone who was going to run around the world, you know, screaming MAGA and all this kind of stuff from the rooftops. And my sense is, and it's complete speculation, but I'm just trying to inhabit Trump's brain, and that's a dangerous place to try and be. But it's just this idea that, firstly, State Department doesn't matter to Donald Trump. It really does. Like, he doesn't care about foreign policy. He basically wants people to do what he says. I suspect on the things that he wants to be harsh on, immigration, Central America, Latin America, the places that he's going to need help with and a firm hand with, Marco Rubio has a lot of credibility in those places. He has a lot of credibility in the Latin American population across America. He has a lot of credibility as a Spanish speaker, as a person from Latin American heritage. So he's going to be, I suspect, well-received in a lot of those places. Not Cuba, but otherwise he's going to be well-received. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is he ticks the box of being a serious partner for the serious people he's going to have to deal with. And that's like the Middle East. It's China. It's arguably European countries, although I don't think Trump cares that much about what European countries think about him. But when Marco Rubio walks into a room, it's not immediately laughable. And, you know, I think if he'd pointed some of the other folks in his orbit, it would have been immediately laughable. And to the extent that Trump cares about foreign policy, I think it's just don't make my job harder than it needs to be. And I think Marco Rubio ticks those boxes. And to what you were saying about the State Department, you know, I remember when I was in China working with the US diplomats in China who were shocked about Donald Trump's election in 2016 and very dejected about it because, you know, it's no secret that bureaucracies tend to skew very, very left wing. So I think they were very upset about Donald Trump's election. When Rex Tillerson was appointed as Secretary of State, people were really upset about it because he was this outside guy. He was this oil guy. And again, left wing. Oh my God, he's the personification of evil because he works for, was he Exxon? I think he was. Yeah. They were very, very negative about him. This time around, I think you're right in saying that State Department is going to be relieved by Marco Rubio. And I think that shows you how far the political spectrum has shifted in America. The idea that diplomats who, and again, I'm speaking for them, and I, you know, this is just my gut sense based on, you know, my experience, they'll be relieved because he seems kind of institutional. He's a creature of Washington. He's not going to run in and fire, you know, 90% of the State Department, or, you know, it's less likely that he's going to run in and fire most of the State Department. And I think going from Rex Tillerson, who's also an establishment guy, we know that now. He didn't particularly like Donald Trump. He was a sensible guy. He ran a huge company. He was within the realm of serious people. But 8 years later, you're thrilled to get a senator who, back then, I think they would have melted down had Senator Rubio been put in charge of the State Department 8 years ago. So I think it shows how far we've moved in what's politically normal.
Yeah, right when you were talking, I just had to look up because I was pretty sure that Qatar had named a vessel Rex Tillerson, and I just had to triple check that they have.
Yeah,
there you go. Speaking of oil and former Secretary of States and their international communities like or dislike for them. Yeah, right. I agreed with all of that.
Do you think there's anything that we can say from Marco Rubio's like foreign policy background that he will focus on? Like, I mean, we know he's a massive critic of Cuba, but that's, you know, whatever. We knew that Trump isn't going to, like, you know, normalize relationship with Cuba. But we wrote about Venezuela. I have this sneaking suspicion that Trump wants to do a deal with Venezuela around legal immigration. A lot of illegal migrants have come from, and I'm using illegal immigration just as a umbrella term for, you know, there's going to be people in our audience who take umbrage with that term, but I'm just using it as like non-legal immigration, you know, people coming across the border and asylum seekers, which I appreciate is not illegal. You know, it's not illegal to seek asylum, but I'm just using it as a general term. But a lot of those folks come from Venezuela and other Central American countries. Do you think Marco Rubio is going to have credibility in those places to go and strike deals to say, hey, we'll have a better relationship with you if you take back a bunch of these folks?
Yeah. So as Jamie Dimon said, where he urged people to read The Art of the Deal, right? Donald Trump wants to strike deals. Mm. And someone like Marco Rubio, who is relatively young, could be a president one day, right, of the United States, wants to probably cement some of these deals under his term. And he can say, you know, when I was Secretary of State, I made a deal with Venezuela. I made a deal with Iran or whatnot. And so I do think that he'll duly carry out whatever deals that Donald Trump wants to strike and probably in future years take some of the credit for some. And I think that you're right. There's been lots of op-eds. I've seen lots over the past few weeks of how the United States has lost Latin America to China. And this was mostly after China inaugurated a port in Lima at the APEC summit. And China has done a lot of investments in Latin America, who traditionally has been a very reliant and a partner on Washington. So I, you know, it's not a stretch, as you say, to potentially think that Marco Rubio, a Spanish speaker, might be looking to cement some of those relationships and ensure that could be a big bid to voters who are quite concerned, given the sure amount of votes that went to Donald Trump about migration flows.
And in a normal world, and I'm, you know, let's say in a pre-Trump world, this would have been seen as a very strong signal that a foreign policy priority of the American government, of the Trump administration, will be Latin America, because you appoint someone who speaks Spanish and is of Spanish heritage, or sorry, Latin American heritage. Big strong signal. I just don't know if we can draw those bows anymore, because Trump, we know, is such a, you know, a capricious, you know, impulse. When I say impulsive, again, I'm not trying to say it's negative. He's a gut feel guy who does things based on his judgment. So like, it could mean that he wants to make things up with Latin America or have good relations with them. It could also mean that Marco Rubio was a guy that he liked that day or liked in the last 6 months. So, you know,
totally. And you see that with any, you know, with Pompeo, with Nikki Haley, who tried to sort of carve their own path, weren't rewarded with any cabinet position. So anyone who seems to be carving their own path at the same time is not rewarded. And therefore, you know, if Rubio is his sights set too much on what he could potentially use in a, you know, presidential run in 2032 or whatever, might not find it quite easy to operate in the 47th president.
Well, exactly. And I think it goes to a challenge that we're going to have over the next 4 years too, is that people who sit around and analyze this stuff, foreign policy experts, think tankers, political experts, they always want to see the pattern and the grand strategy. Because traditionally, I think that, you know, most administrations and political organizations do have some sort of strategic kind of long-term vision. And that's not saying that the Trump administration and the Trump orbit doesn't have that strategy. But I think it can be, you can overinterpret a lot of this stuff with Donald Trump. Focusing on the deals is a more appropriate way to analyze what Donald Trump wants to do. And that's why you see so many folks who know how this world operates getting into his orbit, making them aware of what they can do for him and what they want in return, because that's the way this guy works. It's not about long-term kind of reciprocity. It's about short-term transactionalization. And that's the way that most of the world works. I want to make that very clear too, that a lot of people think of Trump as the aberration and, like, you know, he's a disgrace to foreign policy, all this kind of stuff. Look, honestly, for most of human history and for most countries, foreign policy is a matter of, here are my national interests, here are yours, where can we strike a deal? Now, maybe it's not quite as naked and it's not said as publicly in Twitter posts and truth posts, social posts. And it's a little bit of a, you know, don't say the quiet bit out loud stuff, but this is how the world works and really always has done. So I don't know. I get a little frustrated with the amount of hand wringing around the transactional nature of Donald Trump. It's not great, because I think America has done a really good job of imposing a broader structure on the world where transactionalism wasn't dominant, but this is not kind of, it's not something new, I guess, is what I'm saying. All right. Anything to say about Tulsi Gabbard, the national security advisor, before I rant on too long? She's a far less mainstream pick. Let's start with that.
No, take it away, because she's quite interesting. But I don't actually have too much to say on her myself.
Yeah. Nor do I. And again, I think the first thing is, national security advisor is a really interesting role. You are essentially the overseer of the intelligence collection agencies of the United States. So that includes obviously the CIA. It includes military defense. It includes, I mean, I couldn't even tell you how many different organizations in the United States are charged with collecting intelligence around the world, but there's a lot of them. And her role is kind of like the coordinator of that. So she sits with presumably the ear of the president, and gives policy directives. Let me rephrase that. Not policy directives, kind of political and policy strategic direction filters through her, from the president through her to all of those agencies. Now, it's always really murky, and that sounds super jargony because it kind of is, but it's the idea of, like, okay, the CIA goes and finds this piece of evidence about Iran's whatever. It filters up, and she is the one who kind of filters it through the political lens, the defense lens, the intelligence lens, because you can imagine when you have a bureaucracy this big, no one sees the whole picture. No one really knows what the next hand is doing. And in intelligence communities, that's even more true, because by definition, you're not allowed to know what other people are up to, because that's the job. her job is to kind of try and piece that all together in a jigsaw piece that makes sense, taking into account the CIA director, the president, the Pentagon, the military leaders, all this kind of stuff. So it's this really difficult, weird job. What's important is, I think, for that role, you need someone who is super well respected in the space, who people don't feel like they need to hide things from. They feel like they can share, they can be quite candid with them, with her about, hey, what's the president thinking about this? What advice do we need on that? What's the CIA director hearing about what the Russian FSB director is? You know, you need someone who can kind of have those kind of nod and a wink conversations without them being a risk to your priority. So what I'm trying to get at here is they need to be a real trusted advisor of everybody. They need to play all the sides together. They need to be in the tank for America, not any individual person. And what I'm hearing about Tulsi Gabbard is that no one trusts her. No one knows what she's about. She has this long, weird, checkered past of like flying to Syria years ago when no one knew she was going, like talking to Bashar al-Assad or people in Bashar al-Assad's kind of circle when like the, you know, the Washington wasn't aware. I think that was under either the Trump first term or might've been even under the Obama presidency. She went unsanctioned to Syria. She's parroting Kremlin talking points a lot. So there's this idea that she's, you know, I don't think anyone thinks she's nefariously involved with Russia, but she's obviously sympathetic to some of the things they're saying. She was a Democrat. She was then not a Democrat. Like, so there's this idea that she's just not a super understood person in Washington. And that's a good thing in lots of places. Like, you want to go and shake up the system. You want to, like, we're going to talk about Musk and Ramaswamy later, but like that can be a good thing. But what I'm trying to get across in a long-winded way is this is a role where you really need an institutionally trusted advisor who understands the levers of power and who the, all the people involved in the bureaucracy are going to come to and trust. And I, what I'm hearing is that that's not her, but we'll see.
Mm. Yeah. So kind of just what you said though, right? Do you remember when Kamala Harris had, you know, 100+ national security former advisors endorse her? Tulsi is not part of that list and never would be, and was not, is not associated with those people. And that is what was so attracted to some of the electorate who voted Trump into power. And so her being loyal to Trump, not part of the establishment, as you just said, actually is a plus to so many people. And at the end of the day, actually, right, does she potentially have the trust? Maybe not. But does it matter? Kind of no, because just like I was saying earlier in the podcast, right? Like you could go to a panel and listen all day to someone who was the former NSA, the former, right? And they can say all their opinions. They're never going to make news and they're never going to call the shots and they're never going to have a direct line to the president. So it doesn't matter really if you believe that you can trust Tulsi or not. If you want a line to the president and you don't have one, she just might be that conduit. And so I think in some ways,
I know what you're saying. And I agree with that in principle, except for this role. Like if you know, I think that's what he was trying to achieve with, we're not going to talk about Matt Gaetz, thank God, because he's withdrawn. And I didn't have anything to say there that was going to be particularly groundbreaking other than, you know, the normal, but that's what that works with the Attorney General, I think, because the Attorney General, it's a very defined role. You sit at the head of this organization. You can make directives to your organization. You have the ear of the president. You can do his bidding. This is a different role. It's so amorphous. It's not really a role that existed before. I don't have the facts in front of me, but I think it's the middle to sort of second half of the 20th century was when this role kind of sprung up, when the kind of bureaucracy and the intelligence apparatus of America really started to sprawl. They were like, oh, we need this coordinating person who has the political talent, the political nous to understand what the environment in Washington is and how to get done what we need to get done. It's not a role for the media. It's not a role to send messages. It's not a role in which you impose the will of the president on the bureaucracy. You know, you do that by maybe hiring a CIA director who's MAGA or a FBI director who's MAGA, and you say, you know, fix your department, kill all the people who are anti-me and get, you know, you do what like a Joe McCarthy tried to do with the communist stuff in the 60s. You have a witch hunt. The NSA, I mean, it's Jake Sullivan now. Like, Jake Sullivan makes me news because he kind of goes into meetings with China and says some basic things. But that, like, it's not a... I mean, maybe I'm wrong here. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the role, but my understanding is it's you need someone, if you want that person to be effective and you want them to impose your will on the bureaucracy, they need to be a seriously good operator and know the right buttons to push. And I don't know, but we probably have people in our audience who are far more aware of what Trump's trying to achieve with this role. Because again, Jake Sullivan was politically connected in DC. He's politically connected to the Democratic Party. It's not clear to me that Tulsi Gabbard is particularly connected in MAGA. It's not clear to me that she's particularly connected around the world. Maybe she isn't in Russia. Maybe the answer is right there in what I said at the start about, you know, that's where they want to create better relationships, and she does know those folks. But it's hard for me to believe that she's going to be a net positive. And more than that, I was asked recently by someone who was like, how do countries that share intelligence with America deal with Trump coming in? You know, his first administration leaked like a sieve. What do other countries do? And Australia, my country, is a member of the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Network, which is, you know, ostensibly most of the intelligence that the five countries have, they share with each other. Well, unofficially, you just start to hold stuff back. If you don't think Tulsi Gabbard is someone who you want to trust with, you know, if you're a Canadian and you have some information, because all these services, all these foreign and intelligence services are highly skilled. You have some information and Tulsi Gabbard's on a trip to Ottawa for meetings. Maybe you don't tell her. Maybe you don't tell her because you don't know her. You don't have a relationship with her. You're just not sure she's not going to go back to Donald Trump and it's going to end up on Truth Social tomorrow. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but that's what I'm trying to say is like, you need someone who is a real fundamental of the system person in that role is my sense.
Yeah. It's good. And only time can tell, I guess.
That's right. Do we have anyone else we want to talk about in the transition that stood out to you, Kristen?
I mean, for who replaced Matt Gaetz as the attorney general pick, right? These people are not yet even nominated. The Trump team has not yet signed the transition papers even. That could have changed in the end of the last 48 hours, but I can doubt it, is Pam Bondi, who is only interesting because of her international ties. So
and it goes beyond just having the name of a famous beach in Australia, right?
Right, exactly. Which I'm pretty sure how the American state is also wrong from how.
Incorrect,
And I don't think she pronounces it Bondi or however.
Well, I'm going to call it Pam Bondi and no one can tell me to do anything else.
Well, she might be really in with Bondi Partners, the lobbying firm in Australian lobby firm in DC. And that's her end. So anyways, yeah, I mean, she was lobbying for the Qataris in 2019, earning $115,000 a month. I was looking at the Farah Files, the FARA, which is essentially government platform where you can look up people's names and look up different governments and who they've contracted a lobby for them. And I was like, wait a minute, $115,000 a month. So yeah, and this was at the same time that the firm that she was lobbying with was lobbying for a Turkish bank, was lobbying. I mean, she wasn't working on those cases, but right, they are not, the firm itself has advocated on behalf of lots of partners that have often been at odds with the U.S., so it's just interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, I have nothing to add on that. She passes that kind of test of like, she was floated as attorney general, so she's a sensible kind of credible pick for an attorney general of the country. But I think what you're talking about there just shows that, you know, it's about connection. It always has been about connections in DC, obviously. And again, it's naive of people to say that, oh, well, when Obama was in power or when Biden was in power, Washington worked completely differently. Of course it didn't. It just didn't operate quite so openly. People lobbied politely. They didn't say, I'm here to lobby Donald Trump, whereas now they're more likely to appoint someone who has, you know, played golf with Donald Trump and the media is more likely to report on it. So I don't think any of this is new. Washington has always been a swamp, right?
Which, to note, to Donald Trump and his, you know, posse's credit is sort of it's taking from the liberal book of transparency and having things out in the open. So
that's,
and, you know, and that's where they get some points.
I think that's an interesting, I don't want to compare administrations because, you know, we're not overtly political, but this stuff goes on all the time. What people don't like is having it obviously in their face all the time. That, like, this is how Washington worked. I'm always reminded of this quote. I think it's Anna Applebaum, but she may have been quoting Hannah Arendt, the famous kind of Jewish scholar. But there's this idea that the problem with populism, and I'm massively, massively paraphrasing, the problem with populism isn't that people believe the populist candidates. It's that they become nihilistic. They start to just believe everybody does it the same way. And I think that's what you're seeing right now. It's like, there's been for so long, Washington has been, I'm not going to call it corrupt, but it's an influence game. There's a street in Washington named after the place that all the lobbyists have their offices. You say, oh, I work on K Street, right? And that's like, I'm a lobbyist. This is known stuff. Donald Trump supporters are okay with, I think, the nakedness of it all, because they were like, this has been going on forever. I don't trust any of you. So at least this guy's kind of like telling it how it is. And I think that's the lesson of his appointments to cabinet. Would they pass the old ideas of credible appointments? Well, maybe Rubio, maybe a few others, but a lot of them don't. But who cares? Because they're all the same anyway. That's the mentality of the American people. I think beyond MAGA, I think there's a lot of people outside of that who would agree and just say, Washington's broken. Coming back to what we were talking about in Rome as well, the system's broken, so I don't care. Like, you're not going to fix it anyway. You may as well have a guy in there who's funny, right, and transparent about it.
Throw it all into flames and let's laugh while we're at it.
Yeah. Which brings us to our last point, because we're running long, and this is a bit of a bugbear of mine, is that I want to talk about Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and the Department of Government Efficiency.
Doge, if you will.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that because it's not funny the first time, and it's not funny, you know, the more that they keep saying it. But look, so for folks who don't know about this, it's Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy have been appointed to head this government department. I don't think it's going to become a department. It's more like a task force, where the idea is just to cut the government expenditures, to find efficiencies across bureaucracy, which I think they wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal fairly recently about Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy's plan to reform government will be reversing a decades-long executive power grab. You know, this idea that there's just a ton of people in Washington who aren't elected, they work in the government, and their job is to thwart, they're very left-wing, and their job is to thwart the ideas of anyone who dares be slightly right-wing or conservative. And now, I don't think this is going to go anywhere. I think Musk will grow bored of it pretty quickly. I think he and Donald Trump will fall out sooner rather than later. But beyond that, I used to work in government, and I know a lot of folks who still work in government listen to this. And if they know me personally, they'll know my views on government are pretty robust. I think government is incredibly inefficient. I think it does a lot of things really badly. I think it could be way, way better. But it also does a lot of things really, really well. And the people who work in government are, yeah, could they be more efficient? Of course they could be. But they are smart, generally by and large, smart, engaged people who do good work. They go to work every day. And I don't like the mischaracterization that is cropping up in right-wing circles. Well, actually, I won't even call it right-wing circles. Cropping up generally that government is lazy and inefficient. It is to an extent, but that's too broad a brush to paint. So do I think that this needs to happen? Yes, I do. I actually do think that government needs to be restructured and reformed because it's not working for the people. If there's anything that we know from the multilateral institutions, we were talking about the G20, the G7, down to local governments, they aren't reflecting people's needs and wants particularly well anymore. So I actually, Kristen, I want to say something provocative to you. I am kind of pro the Department of Government Efficiency. I'm not pro the language they're using. I'm not pro I'm not pro the kind of like stigmatizing folks who try to work in government because they don't they wanted to give back a public service. But I don't like the idea that it's farcical. Like, government is too big. There are too many people on the federal paycheck doing things that don't need to be done. Like, organizations only grow in one direction. They don't ebb and flow. They get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. They don't ever get smaller. So sometimes you need to cut them. I don't know. What do you think?
Is this government's move fast and break things moment?
Well, yeah, right. And so that's going to get me to my next point, but I want you to like engage with it. Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing? Do you think that this is the right way to go about things? Or do you think that, it's just all kind of nonsense and there's no problem?
Yeah. Well, I'm not a government worker, but I will say I know many government workers who cast their votes for Donald Trump. So they are in the system currently. They feel that the Trump administration and his allies, such as Elon Musk, have expressed this and they've identified and recognized it. So I think, you know, that to me shows a surefire sign. There's also many who are vehemently against it. But the fact that there are even people who in government actively, you know, who say, hey, my job actually might not even really shouldn't exist. This could be more efficient or XYZ other jobs tells me that there's probably some validity to it. I mean, I don't know if they'll be raising though, if DOGE does become some sort of agency and then slashes their job, right? I mean, that government pension is quite nice, and that 20-year mark is something that people all across the DC area just wait and yearn for, to be able to rake that in. But apparently, from what I've heard, the government pension isn't even as grand as it was 50 years ago. So what are you waiting for? And so, I think you're onto something. I think it's something that government workers themselves have been saying quietly for some time.
Yes. And here's the thing. I mean, I think in that article, they said they want to reform. I mean, the article is full of nonsense. Let me just say that too. Like, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy have...
You're talking about the Wall Street Journal op-ed.
We'll post it in the show notes. It's this idea that they lay out their case for, like, you know, basically shrinking the government by a lot in terms of firing workers. And core to it is this idea that they say that the bureaucracy is this own organism now. It doesn't answer to the president. It often thwarts the president, which is, you know, something we've heard from Donald Trump in the first 4 years, that the deep state thwarted his ideas for remaking the country. Liberals said, oh, thank God we had checks and balances. Right-wing folks said, how dare you? He was the duly elected president of the United States. You have to do what he says. Both have cases, in my view. It's not one or the other. It's a bit of both. But what they say they're going to do is make it easier to fire people within the federal government. And again, my knee-jerk reaction is good. My experience in the Australian government was it was absurdly hard to fire people for poor performance. Absurdly hard, laughably hard. But the reason that is the case, and there's a lot of links to, you know, the education system, university tenure, professors' tenure, is that you don't want it to be easy to fire someone on a whim when that's political. Like, if the government changes, you don't want someone who's crazy to come in and be like, I don't like the look of your tie, you're done. Because the idea is that there should be continuity in government, because government shouldn't be political. It should be this idea of, like, well, social security checks still have to get cut and delivered. So if you start firing people willy-nilly, then we need to have some resilience in the system to protect it from the public services falling apart. So it shouldn't be easy to fire people. And then obviously that transforms into, well, that's also a perk of the job, which allows government to pay less because there's more job security. So all of these things are really difficult questions. And what I go back to is, like, yes, government is too big. Yes, it is too inefficient. And yes, there are too many examples of people on government payrolls doing bad jobs. But here's the difference and why I'm worried about Elon Musk. So I'm going to argue against what I said about it being a good thing. Elon Musk is famous for coming into his companies and going hardcore. When something needs to happen, he sleeps on the factory floor. He camps out in Pennsylvania and gets Donald Trump elected. He cuts 80% of Twitter staff or whatever it was. He goes all in, and I think the phrase I've heard used is he burns the boats. He makes sure that there are no other options other than success or failure. And it's all in or we fail. And it's a really powerful mentality to have in the private sector, in technology, in startups, because too many times big companies, big organizations fail because they have optionality. They don't do anything well because they have too many options. So they just do a bit of everything and nothing works. He is very good at making sure that's not the reason a company fails. But if a company fails, people lose their jobs. So what? Life goes on. They're probably coders. They can go get another job in Silicon Valley. If he brings that approach to government, people don't get welfare checks. People don't get disability help. People won't, like, services will break if he takes the mentality that he has shown across his career in the private sector. And that's my worry is, you know, risk aversion in government is the biggest frustration. People don't do anything because they're scared of making mistakes because people's lives are on the line. In Silicon Valley, every investor expects 9 out of their 10 investments to fail because the one that wins is where you make your money. And it's this complete reversion of risk aversion. It's the idea of, like, you got to take shots to get a win. Government is the absolute opposite. Is if you take shots, you break things, and that means people's lives are affected.
Yeah.
So that's my worry.
Well, let me give just a counter argument to that really quickly, and then we can kind of close up is...
Yes. Stop me ranting. Sorry.
The American electorate would tell you that it's already broken, right? We don't have something like the NHS. So if you're not, it's not like you've already been paying for your healthcare out of pocket. Your student loans, you already have to pay. The government is not paying for that university for you to attend. All these things, and a lot of the subsidies are also at a state level. So, okay, if the thinking is true that, you know, this nihilism has set in, that it's already burning, it's like, well, let's just burn it faster then. And so many of these things, like healthcare,
how much worse,
like education, right? How much worse can it get? And the American electorate would tell you, well, I already have to foot the bill for community college, which, you know, Joe Biden wanted to get through as being completely free, but no, I'm still paying for it. And Obama wanted to get Obamacare through, but oh no, it still costs $600 if you're not getting health insurance through a job. So well, burn it, right? And so if this nihilistic thinking has set in, right, like to what you say, right? Okay, you're not going to get your welfare check. Well, someone might say, well, it's already taken me 8 weeks to fight for a welfare check from 6 months ago. So
who cares?
Whatever. Mm-hmm. Burn it down, set it all up, and make sure that I can file my taxes on a centralized system and I don't have to do some turbo tax that's, you know, got an ad out of me and $49 in the meantime. And so I think that's where there's maybe the counter argument.
No, I think it's a great point. I think my only kind of comment would be people will be shocked how much worse things can get. I mean, yeah. FEMA is pretty good at disaster recovery. If it loses 80% of its workforce, I wonder how good it would be. But, you know, it's a great point. And I actually think it's a great way to tie out this final election intrigue podcast, because this is what you're getting at there is the fundamental mistake of the last 30 years of what I'll call liberal politics. And I don't mean that left wing. I mean that like American Western liberal free market mentality is that famously Francis Fukuyama, you know, misquoted, massively misinterpreted, but that end of history quote that America, the West won the Cold War, that's done. Put that in the box. We'll move on now. And the problem, the mistake that we collectively have made is that realizing that, like, things are circular, things are cyclical. You need to continually reiterate and make an argument for the status quo. You can't just act like the status quo is the status quo and will go on forever. So if you believe in Western democracy and free trade, you need to continually every day be showing benefits and making that argument for why it should exist. If you are on the left side of politics and you believe in government and public services, you need to be continually showing and making it better and improving to people why this exists. Because if you don't do that and you just assume, like, well, obviously we won the battle, we won the war, we won the argument, time passes and people aren't happy anymore. And they elect people who say, I'll blow the system up. And that's where we are right now, because people have forgotten to make the argument consistently for the world and on a foreign policy, you know, foreign policy mentality. We haven't made an argument for why the current global order is a good global order and benefits people. And so it's going away, and it is going away. And I think it's an interesting kind of link between domestic politics and international politics, and something we're going to watch over the next 4 years very closely. So I don't know. With that, Chris, it might be a good way to tie up generally this series that we've been doing and think about how we might continue our podcast in the future. But yeah.
All right. It's time to go find these people who are advocating.
This was 50 minutes of me ranting mostly. I'm very sorry about that. But I feel like I've had a lot on my mind. My sickness gave me time to think about things. So always dangerous.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Kristen. I appreciate it.